Welcome to our podcast at agendadigitale.eu.
Welcome to Secure in Mind, the podcast where we discuss technology, ethic, responsibility, and the development of artificial intelligence. We discuss why all of these things matter to the everyday citizen. And we aim to talk with people from a variety of different areas, military, government, private sector, technology, ethics, journalism. And the reason that we do this is because a lot of them are very much interrelated. And sometimes we just need to show how they are, where the linkages are, and give people a bit of food for thought to take away with them. So we present under the platform cybersecurity360.com. And today we have a very special guest. His name is Roberto Capocelli. Roberto and I have known each other for over a year now, I guess. And we get along like a house on fire for all the Italians. That means we get along very well. it's a strange idiom from, I don't know, Australia or England. And Roberto has a different background to many of the guests that we've had on before, but I think it's going to be a really, really interesting discussion. So strap yourselves in. He is a journalist who specializes in international relations and politics and economics. He currently works as a press officer for a senator in the Italian parliament, Mr. Riccardo Nencini. He's passionate about technology and its impacts on politics, human rights, and privacy. That's the intro that he sent me. He's being modest. He's also a Fulbright scholar, which is a very big deal. And he can go into that during our walk through his background. He's won a number of grants and scholarships, it seems. So I'll let him do a bit of a presentation over his background. But without any further ado, welcome, Roberto.
Thank you very much, Nick, for having me. It's a pleasure being with you today here.
Excellent. Pleasure's all mine, mate. Basically, with all the guests that I have on, I want to humanize the person behind the policy maker or the policy. So without sort of looking at just some of the tech stuff, give us a rundown of your background, maybe what drove you to become interested in international relations, in journalism, in technology and its impact on humanity, and walk us up to, you know, where you are now.
Okay, Nick, thank you so much again. So, I was a student in communication and journalism in Rome a few years ago now. And then in 2002, I started out as a freelance reporter. I still was a student at the time, and I traveled to Palestine during the Second Intifada uprising. It was a big, big deal on the news at the time. So I wanted to see a touch with my hands. What was going on over there. And then ever since I've been traveling and working in several countries, including Lebanon, Egypt, Mexico. I lived in Colombia working as a human rights officer for an NGO called Peace Brigades International. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been working on and off journalism, human rights, NGOs. And when I was in Colombia, I also did a documentary on gold mining. And after that, I was in the Congo, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, working for the UN. And then back to Italy as a political reporter. And as you were mentioning in your introduction, in recent years, I lived in New York City for a couple of years on a Fulbright scholarship, specializing in journalism and economics. What brings me here today is that I've always been fascinated by politics and in general by the idea of empowering people and communities who have less power in society. And I do believe that a big chunk of this battle nowadays takes place on a battlefield called technology. And by the way, unfortunately, in my opinion, we are currently kind of losing this battle for empowering people and community through technology. So we need to fight like way much harder. Mm. That's a little bit who I am and where I am now.
Fascinating history. And this is the stuff that I really enjoy getting into. It touches me as well because I have lived in a number of very, you know, outlandish places. Give us a sense, because drawing from my own experience, and obviously this is about you, not me, but drawing from my own experience, I really noticed the impact of having physical security or a lack of physical security in some of the places that I've lived in. how much of a profound effect that had on my outlook and also my motivation to affect change and affect awareness in other countries where rights are so much more prevalent. Give us a sense of how the lack of security impacted your awareness and also motivation to actually pursue a course and push this understanding into different countries like that can offer the support.
Working in countries like, you know, especially in South America or in Palestine, in Africa is a little bit less, at least where I was. I'm sure that other countries in Africa is a different world. But, you know, you bumped into the problem of security and technology. Mm. It's simply very easy for government who would like to attack human rights defender to use like technology to spot what they consider being an enemy. So, for instance, in Latin America, many human rights organizations, including international organizations, they are forced to use encryption for their communication because they are aware that sometimes government or other entities are continuously trying to use the inevitable flux of information that goes through technology, through email, through phone calls, to acquire information for illegitimate purposes.
And did you experience this firsthand, as far as you know?
Well, when I was living in Latin America, there was a huge scandal involving one of the governments of, at the time, I'm talking about more than 10 years ago, there was a huge scandal involving one of the government who was constantly spying on legitimate international organization operating within this country to try to organize what they call una campaña de desprestigio. I mean, a smear campaign against international human rights organization.
And this is certainly, this is one of those topic areas which it's fascinating. And it's something that bringing it back to people's awareness in, say, countries like Australia, like Italy, for example, there's much more robust procedures around the surveillance or around the intrusion of someone's information, whether it be via email or phone. Of course, it does happen. But it's much more selected, and there, you know, there is purportedly a democratic function and a judicial oversight that limits the government's ability to use it on, you know, anyone that they want to target. Those types of restrictions aren't so relevant in other countries of the world.
Yeah, for sure, there are like judicial system that works much better in some areas of the world comparing to other. This is for sure. There are some states who have much more controls and mechanism in place to make sure that this, you know, the use of phone tapping, email interception, and so forth and so on is not used in an illegitimate way. Nevertheless, and that's my personal opinion, Nick, I do believe that, yes, law is very important, of course. The problem is when something is very easy, very cheap, and no one can actually check out on you whether you're doing something legitimate or illegitimate, well, problems are going to happen.
Absolutely.
And I think that nowadays, you know, an illegitimate or uncontrolled use of spying technology is too easy, too cheap, too accessible to make low enforceable completely, 100%.
Absolutely, yeah. And again, the accessibility is right there as soon as you plug into the internet with the right tools and the smarts and the source code or code that you build yourself, you can actually affect these. So that's
If I can draw a comparison, excuse me, Nick. If I can draw a comparison, so you have the Geneva Convention and Protocol and stuff like this, but if you are lost in the middle of the jungle and no one is watching you and someone is threatening you to violate your rights, you can say, yeah, there is a Geneva Convention, but this person will, you know, there won't be anyone to enforce this convention in this situation. When it comes to tech and digital, let's call it espionage or whatever you want to call it, we are in a very similar situation. We are in the middle of the jungle.
I like that analogy. I think that's a great one. That's drawing from the African experience in the jungle, I believe. So Okay, so I think we'll certainly look at some of that discussion more later in the episode. I want to look at the overarching connection between something like cybersecurity, the implementation of overarching, broad-reaching policies, try to trickle down into the local council, through the state, through the region, up to the, well, at least in the United States and Australia, the federal government. Can you give us a sense of the political atmosphere, I guess, in Italy, because that's where you're based at the moment, in terms of continuity of the implementation of policy and structure for large programs, which do need to cater for all different areas of government, including military, including intelligence, but including the local citizenry as well. And give us a sense of whether it's specifically about the cybersecurity component or not, a sense of that implementation of long-term policy and large reach policy.
Well, first, to implement long-term policy, you first need to have a policy. And that's the major point I would like to add.
Yeah, so, it helps.
It helps. Sometimes if you have a policy, you can implement a long-term policy. So obviously, in the last 15, 20 years, technology became a major part of what is generally considered security. Mm. This is, you know, you can apply this to an organization, an international organization. You can apply this to a state. You can apply this to general geopolitical balance across the world. We all know that, you know, it's been a long time. We've been listening for a long time now about, you know, cyber warfare and how this actor, this state actor is trying to acquire an advantage on the other and so forth and so on. Italy, not just Italy, let's say, in general, but let's concentrate on our country. So Italy obviously has not been leading in the digital revolution across the world. We know how the digital revolution came about and we were not in the middle of this. So of course, we are trying to adjust to what's going on at the global level. As you can imagine, there are different actors. There are political actors, private sector actors, and then within those systems, there are people who think differently and have different agenda. In recent years, there was an effort, of course, to try to coordinate the security when it comes to the cyberspace, because this is what we're talking about, security when it comes to the new space that exists in social life, which is cyberspace. Efforts were made. I think they created a cyber command, which is in charge of controlling, you know, the cyber defense of the state. And obviously, it came into also the political agenda. The previous government tried to make an effort to... There was also a huge, like, you know, it became a political battle, of course. Probably there are different school of thoughts. Somehow, Italy is part of a wider, you know, we're part of the NATO, we're part of a wider Western world bloc. Nevertheless, I do believe there are people who think that we should have a sort of autonomy within this, you know, allegiance, you know, belonging to the wider, a wider structure. We should have some kind of autonomy because, you know, when it comes to information, when it comes to managing of your critical infrastructure, you want to have like control of what's going on. Mm. You don't want to be in the hands of someone else who have access to all of your information and can control the decision that you make.
This sounds quite relevant in terms of the information sharing abilities and not so much oversight, but the force from the larger parties. So, for example, the country where I'm from, Australia, is a part of the Five Eyes from an intelligence perspective. That includes the United States, Canada, England, Australia, and New Zealand. And from, you know, many discussions with many people in those areas, certainly the heavyweight is the United States. And when they lean on for information, then the others generally would comply more. I wonder whether that's sort of transferable if you look at, say, Italian context in terms of the European information sharing platform, or do you think I'm completely off mark?
Well, I don't think you're completely off mark. Once a very important politician in Italy, once say recently, actually, a few months ago, I was working for a series of conferences. Well, he said, his name is Giuliano Amato, is well known in Italy, say, well, Europe is a place of cooperation, but at the same time, Europe is the place also of competition when it comes to security, defense, geopolitics, economics, information, is everything. The person who have a wider view of what's going on, if he wants to cooperate with you, then good. If he wants to compete with you, he will gain the upper hand somehow. So, you know, we don't have to forget that there is always this dual element of cooperation and competition.
I agree 100%. It's and that duality will not go away. It's just part of life. Looking at it from a
philosophical.
Yeah, it's the yin and yang, baby. If we look at Italy's background from a political sense, and I'm interested in this as well because you know more than anyone who I know about Italian political history. So where were we, 40 years ago up until now? And what do you think the future holds in terms of, for example, implementing effective policies and also, for example, how we look in terms of the European Union and different collaborative measures that are being undertaken? And certainly in the climate that we're in now with the interference that you see on electronic cyber platforms in terms of political influence. So
obviously, there is a huge battle going on to acquire advantage in the cyber space, let's call it that way, when it comes to creation of political consensus. You know, the Cambridge Analytica scandal and what happened with the last election in the United States with the election of President Donald Trump, you know, was just the last leg of a long journey. I see this from a media and journalism perspective, but it can be completely translated into, you know, creation of consent, political consent. While before you had newspaper, television, radio, like broadcast, and the advertisement industry, for instance, was like shooting in the dark.
Yeah.
Yes, you had statistical tools and measure and instruments to try to measure who was watching what and when at what time.
Maybe someone will pick it up, someone won't, but it's just...
There is this famous say of an American businessman who used to say, you know what, I'm spending a fortune on advertisement and I know half of this fortune goes to the bin. The problem is I don't know which half, so I have to pay it all. Now it's like having, before we were shooting in the dark, now is having a sniper that shoots you in the middle of your head. So same thing is going to happen with politics. When you have continuous, omnipervasive system, each citizen has got in his pocket a smartphone. It can be measured, controlled. His opinions, what he likes, what he doesn't. Of course, this goes straight into the political realm, no doubt. We all know what the United States and other governments say about, you know, Russian meddling in the election. It wouldn't shock me that someone is trying to meddling in someone else's election. It has always happened. The thing is, if we want to create implement democratic protocols in the realm of technology to avoid that anyone can actually influence too much political processes. That's the point. It's not about, you know, identify the good guys and the bad guys. If you create a tool to influence, someone is going to use it. So either you implement protocols to make this process much more transparent, democratic, and, you know, you empower the people who use it, or it's either you or someone else.
And it certainly is both.
And certainly is both.
Both and everyone. It was, as a slight segue, I remember someone posting an article about Russia's meddling and just using that word again and again and again, meddling on the state and on media in order to garner that public support and persecution and meddling. Okay, yeah, they meddled. But hey, you've done it too. So
yeah, exactly.
Let's have some balance here, guys.
Exactly.
You know, spot on, right? If you know, the the tool is going to be out there. If transparency is key, then we understand who is meddling, or we understand that there is meddling. Not who, because the who's, yes, it's relevant for to a certain degree that you can attribute, say, you're an adversary, but realistically, if the tool's there as a nation state with nation state interests, you would use that tool too. And there's a lot of oversight that can go under, that go on top of it to say how much oversight. But I mean, realistically, we look from a history perspective, how effective has that been when it's balanced against financial and fiscal interests and resource interests? Well, jury's out. So nicely explosive topic we can use right there for this podcast. I love them. So moving on, if we consider some of the steps that you're aware of that are happening within the European context, as far as combating some of the things that we've just been discussing, if you're not too familiar with it, no worries. We can move to the next subject. But are you sort of aware of some of the steps and measures that the EU is taking?
Well, that's my personal opinion, of course. I don't think the EU, again, is now leading the battle on technology itself. We are kind of trying to measure and try to understand what can be done to contain some damages. So take, for instance, the GDPR, the regulation on privacy. It's kind of a wake-up call. It's we got a problem. Houston, we got a problem. Mm. While on the other side of the Atlantic, it's just like, and I had this experience of studying and working in the United States. And personally, when I was even at the university, I was shocked sometimes by the attitude of my colleagues from the other side of the ocean. And they were shocked by mine also. When I was raising privacy issues, they were like, no, there is no problem. I mean, Google is the good guy. So what you complain about, you shouldn't have any fear about giving your data because they are on the right side of history. So again, Europe, I think it right now is trying to understand how to implement policies and to put limitation to a huge tsunami wave that it's, impacting on us.
Yeah.
Is this an effective approach or attitude? In my personal opinion, I don't think so. I think you should be proactive and you should find, as the EU, you should try to create a different structure of technology. Because again, we go back to the thing we were saying at the beginning of this podcast. If it's too cheap, too easy to use, and no one can control you, even if you have legislation that restricts your action in place, you're not going to get it. Mm-hmm. Because, you're not, if you cannot enforce it, then it doesn't make sense. Mm. Again, on privacy, we're doing this, including on taxation as European Union. We're trying to understand that it is simply not possible that some companies simply do not pay taxes because this is not the way society works. Mm. Nevertheless, we are not proactively trying to create an alternative technological infrastructure which would make this balance of power much more easy than it is today.
To say about the will to change, there are a number of European countries whose vested interest is in, this is slightly away from security, but whose vested interest is in maintaining their notoriety, I would say, as tax havens and places where there is a very, very reduced tax rate for the ultra-rich. And there's very little will for that to change within the European Union. Now, other countries, parliamentarians, senators, etc., people are trying to push for that legislative change in these different regions, but certainly there's a lot of resistance for obvious reasons.
For obvious reasons, for sure.
For obvious reasons. So, no, that just sprang to mind. That's another one. And I guess the fact that the head of the EU is actually, I think he's a board of directors from some of those banks as well. So anyway, you can see from that sort of brief economic example that things are tough.
Yeah.
Summarize it like that. Roberto, what's next for you in working in politics? You've got an incredible background in journalism. Every time I catch up with you, I walk away very, very inspired. What's next for you now? Are you looking to Italy to push in this political area? Are you looking at Europe as well as places for change? Or what kind of projects are you up to?
I'm definitely looking at Europe. How can I frame this? I do believe there is a, let's call it, for sure there is a need of transforming the way political consents and political management is carried out. There is this need. There are different actors who realize that this need is strong, is there, and we need to do something. There is a lack of, you know, practical proposal and organization. And I think we should work on this for sure at the European level. We're going to have election next year. They're going to be very tough election for Europe because, you know, there are some political forces who, you know, they are reluctant to make the European project stronger than it is now. They are reluctant to give more power to the EU institution and therefore to take power from nation states, which should be, you know, the idea of Europe. If we want to create a real, you know, European Union, like United States of Europe, at the end of the day, the thing you have to do, you have to devolve power from nation state to a central authority. When it comes to technology, for instance, just to make a like an example, you know, we've been told the history of Silicon Valley and these hippies who were in California in their garage, you know, smoking spliff, and they were very creative and stuff like this. What happened, you know, huge digital revolution that happened through the internet, and then, you know, Clinton, you know, gave the patent away and so forth and so on, but starts with the huge investment. This investment comes from probably trillions of dollars spent in defense research. That's one example. Another example, another two big powerhouse when it comes to cyber and digital is China and Russia. Again, those are two examples where the management of this huge revolution and transformation is not left to a chaotic individual initiative in different ways. And obviously I don't, you know, I may like more some than others, of course, but all those three examples in three different ways, it's a history of centralized decision that then they were, you know, given in different ways through different channels with different political culture. They went there, those decisions then they were led to the kind of private initiative or other kind of actors. But at the beginning, there was a huge project. If Europe wants to be in this, needs to have much more central power. We need to take decision, which, you know, unlike other of those actors I mentioned, they have to be democratic. So you have to be a process of democracy. But once you get to, you know, to the legitimate representation of, you know, people's vote or people's will, then you need to have a structure that can implement change.
Well said. And it's a good mention of, say, a system like China's, for example, which is highly centralized. And even the private corporations are certainly under the, not even under the influence, they are a part of the government's, one of the government's facets. And look at how they're able to roll out different portions of, you know, for us from a Western vantage point, Orwellian and horrifying surveillance tech. But, you know, in their terms, and many Chinese people would agree that some of these surveillance measures that they use and the social credit score, which is a hugely controversial thing in the West, are much more attributed and adopted socially by the Chinese. And that's for multiple reasons, including background, including the propaganda, the way it's presented by the Chinese administration. But if you think about that centralized model for 1.4 billion people, it does seem like a fairly smart model, you know, and there are pros and cons to each. And of course, you can argue both, which is why we had this beautiful thing called politics and debate, because both have very valid points. So, yeah.
For sure, Nick, but even, you know, you mentioned the social credit score in China. Now, again, we go back to the same thing we were saying before. It's not about the bad guys. And I mean, I understand that we are very influenced by this Hollywood mentality that there is a good guy and a bad guy. I do not believe in this.
Yeah.
I think that the methodology, the process in place make the difference. So, yes, for sure, in China, we have the social credit score. Isn't it a little bit the same thing that is already happening and will happen more and more in our Western society? When you have, you know,
absolutely, control, but it wasn't framed that way in the news.
Exactly. So is just about what protocol. So freedom, democracy, individual freedom, it's a protocol. It's a methodology. It's not about if you are good or bad. If Nick is good and Roberto is bad or vice versa. It's about what process you have in place. And if you want a more democratic society, you have to create processes in place that diffuse power instead of concentrating power in a few hands. Then, of course, there is a tension there because, you know, then you want to have a legitimate powers that can interact among themselves. But at the same time, you close when the process is legitimate, when you have representation of social instances coming from different parts of society, then you want that those authorities who are transparent, who represent the different interests in society, they may also can take position. And you do not, because another way not to have democracy is to paralyze the democratic process. If no one takes decision, guess what? At the end, the guy with the upper hand will take control and he will take decision for everyone. So there is a tension. It's like walking on a wire. You don't have to fall on authoritarianism. You don't have to fall on chaos because chaos is the door to authoritarianism.
Look, I think we'll end on that note, Roberto. And I've really, really enjoyed this conversation. Every week or so, putting out another podcast about a different aspect of cyber. And I've got to say, with yours and my background and just thinking about your background and also your interest in this international relations, I do hope to do more of these types of episodes. So last bit, I guess, in all these podcasts is a plug, a shameless plug. So have you got anything? Are you selling any books? selling any secondhand furniture, anything that you want, anything that you want to discuss, and let the audience know, because we've got a fairly large and rapidly growing audience. So, and if anyone can hear you at a speech or a presentation that you're doing, etc.
No, I'm not selling any book or furniture right now. Yes, I don't know. You tell me if you want to add something specifically on politics in Italy.
Well, watch this space. Certainly, it's I think you know, engaging discussions about much more focus on the cybersecurity aspect and getting that level of awareness up is part and parcel of this podcast, and not just for Italy, European and global. Again, the fact that this is done by an Australian in Italy has no bearing on its impact because it's listened to people from the other part of the world and just as relevant. So, okay, so if there's no specific places, if anyone does want to get in touch with Roberto, please feel free to contact me and I'll be happy to have a chat with him and see if he wants to share his details. In the meantime, I'm sure you can find, have you got a sort of a landing page as well, Roberto?
Not now, actually. I used to have a website, but then, you know, this is kind of typical thing that you create because everyone is doing it. And then at some point they say, you know what? I don't need it. I don't need to have a website. Okay. So I have an email and a mobile phone.
Okay. Well, if anyone is urgently looking to get in touch, then you'll have to go through me. So,
correct.
Roberto, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm very much looking forward to catching up in Rome sometime very soon. And thank you for your contribution to Secure in Mind.
My great pleasure. Thanks for inviting me, Nick.
No worries. Take care, mate. Bye.
Bye.
Welcome to our podcast at agendadigitale.eu.